is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, April 10th, 2024. And today will be better than yesterday. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home in Montana. Taylor Schwenk is working from the Schwenk Studios, where there's massive celebration going on because Jackson Holliday has been promoted to the big leagues. And presumably, Taylor, he's going to make his debut later today at Fenway Park.
Official sounder for Jackson Holliday. Shout out Vampire Weekend. It is a holiday, Buster. Very exciting. Mike Elias decided the Tony Kemp experiment not worth it anymore. Is that what we arrived on here?
I don't know. First, I got thoughts on that in just a second, but I want to hear how you heard the news.
I was trying to put Lola to sleep, and the text started flying in. Our buddy Alex with ESPN PR texted me. The Orioles group chat was a flame immediately, and then I'm starting to scroll through social media, and it was real. Jeff Passan reporting.
Yeah, and we're never going to know for sure what conversations took place behind the scenes, but I'll always believe, Taylor, that Jackson Holliday forced their hand. They were fine leaving him in the minors, manipulating his service time, and he just went off, hitting lefties, hitting righties, hitting everything. He scored 18 runs in 10 games. He posted an OPS of 1077 as part of that really potent Norfolk lineup. And meanwhile, as you referenced, the O's have struggled for offense from their second baseman and third baseman early on. I think the Orioles leadership just ran out of excuses to leave in the minors. I do wonder if John Angelos is still owning the team, if this would have been the case. What about you?
Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting because he's a couple days away from a key service time date. I mean, for management to really decide that, like, we just got to bring him up with that date looming, given their track record. I mean, this is a big step. You know, we joke about, you know, the Orioles front office, you know, adhering to this mathematical orthodoxy that they cannot break from. And here they are breaking it. And you and I texted back and forth. I was like, is there something else here that we're missing? Maybe he's signed an extension and you're saying that he's just forced his way in. We've seen him play, you know, we've seen the statistics. And if that is the case, that is quite refreshing and exciting.
Yeah. Now your conspiracy theory is then potentially maybe you're right. If they worked out an extension, and I've heard this happen with teams like the Astros, and Mike Elias used to work for the Astros, where they basically would dangle promotion to big leagues while also putting an extension in front of them. And the players understood what was being said, mm-hmm. right? You want to come to the big leagues? Sign the extension. So I guess we'll see in time. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm okay. That would be great. I mean, we talked about it in spring training. You know, if he signed a big deal, that would be a great sign to fans that we're headed in a new direction with this team. And also, you know, there's been a lot of like back and forth on, you know, there's a whole bunch of guys in AAA that everyone feels should be promoted, but like, where should they go? Like who is, you know, being expunged from the roster. And I think, you know, this is a good first step and I think we should just enjoy it. And, you know, this was the easy one. You know, we knew that Tony Kemp had to go. Hey, first of all, he got the bag, man. $1 million for, you know, 10 games and, you know, maybe 10 a plate appearances. Good for him. Enjoy it, Tony. But this was the easy one. Now, you know, you're not playing like, oh, do we get rid of Hayes, the all-star in the outfield? Do we DFA Ramon Urias, who won a gold glove 2 years ago? We knew Tony Kemp for Jackson Holliday. Easy. Done. I'm excited. I'm ready to enjoy.
Well, and if a lot of executives I've spoken to are right, the Orioles just promoted one of the best players under 23 years old right away. And, you know, based on what we saw him do in AAA, it would not be surprising if he had an impact. The Ones Who Get It Done is brought to you by Grainger. With supplies and solutions for every industry, Grainger has the right product for you. Call like Grainger.com or just stop by. You know who got it done yesterday? Salvador Perez. The Astros and Royals had a great game with Kansas City coming back from a 3-0 deficit to tie the score. And then in the 10th inning, Salvi did this.
Suero delivers. Salvi rips it. Left center field. Down into the gap. That's a base hit. Hampson takes off for third. He rounds the bag. The Astros don't even bother to pick it up. Hampson scores standing. The Royals win the game. El Capitan comes through in the clutch.
Another impressive moment for the Kansas City Royals early this season. You know who else got it done? Tyler Glasnow, the Dodgers. He was dominant in Minnesota.
The stretch and the 0-2. Strike three. Third time in Glasnow's career, he has struck out 14 in a game. That strikeout ties his career high. What a night for Tyler Glasnow.
That was Tim Neverett, AM 570 LA Sports. The Dodgers win that game 6-3. The Yankees edge the Marlins 3-2 with help from Alex Verdugo.
High drive, right field. There it goes. See ya. Verdugo goes yard. 1-0 Yanks.
That was Michael Kay on the Yes Network. The Blue Jays beat the Mariners. Bobichet broke through for his first home run of the season.
The 1-2. High drive, left field, way back, out of here. Second deck blast, Bobichet, 3-0 Blue Jays.
Yeah, it was Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Ex-Dodgers pitcher Julio Urias was charged with 5 misdemeanors. This is reported by our Alden Gonzalez. The charges filed in Los Angeles Superior Court included 1 count of spousal battery, 1 count of false imprisonment, 1 count of assault, and 2 counts of domestic battery involving a dating relationship, according to a spokesperson for the city attorney's office. These charges came after Urias' September arrest on suspicion of felony domestic violence. And, of course, after this case is resolved, then he also will face further Major League Baseball discipline. He's already been suspended 1 time under baseball's domestic violence policy. In Texas, the Rangers carried a lead over the A's into the 9th inning, and that went away.
Leclerc's pitch swung on, fly ball, left center field and deep. Back is Jankowski at the wall. A 3 homer night for Shane Langeliers. The Keller kid delivers, brings home Hernandez, and the A's for the first time tonight lead it. It's 4-3 Oakland.
So, Taylor, the other day before our Sunday night broadcast, we're in Bruce Bochy's office, and he was watching the A's game play out as we were talking to him. He goes, oh, great, the A's are getting hot. And I just joked out loud to this room, like, that's the first time this has been uttered this year. Boch was serious, and apparently he was right.
I guess so. Shea Langeliers might be the best name in baseball for me right now.
There you go. Out in San Diego, Christopher Morel had a big swing.
Here's the pitch. High fly ball, hit to deep left center field. Forget about it. Long gone. A grand slam home run. Christopher Morel. 5-0 Cubs here in the 5th. It went into the second deck.
And the Cubs beat the Padres 5-1. David Bednar of the Pirates blew a lead in a tough loss to the Tigers and was booed by fans in Pittsburgh. And after the game, Rowdy Tellez stepped in to speak on behalf of his teammate when he met with reporters.
This is the pride of Pittsburgh to everybody. We don't do that out here. We're a good team. We're winning for a reason. We're going to get our man back on track, but what happened today is, I think, unacceptable, and we as a group in Pittsburgh got to be better. It's an all-star for a reason, and we just have to be better. So that being said, 2-time all-star.
I thought that was really cool, Taylor. Rowdy Tellez.
Literally,
what'd you think?
Put his arm around the guy. It definitely means a lot, and I love Rowdy, too. I like the cohesiveness we're seeing in Pittsburgh here. Sign of a good team.
Yeah, let's get him on a podcast sometime here in the next couple of weeks. That was really cool.
Ooh, love that video.
Orioles, Red Sox in Fenway Park before the news of the Jackson Holiday promotion was announced. Here's what happened at the top of the 4th.
The 2-2 to Couser. Line drive, base hit left center field. That will plate 2. Mountcastle down to score. Mullins behind him. Couser digging for 2. And he is safe. He dropped the ball. Hamilton couldn't hang on. And Couser has 2 doubles, and he drives in 2 more. He's having a big day, and it's 3-1 Baltimore.
After WBAL, the Orioles beat the Red Sox 7-1. The Orioles had some really ragged defensive play, including its shortstop, because they're now without Trevor Story for the rest of the year. He's headed for season-ending shoulder surgery after a fracture was discovered, and he was emotional when speaking with reporters.
You know, missing last season, you feel that, you know, you miss your teammates, you miss playing the game. You just know what it takes, you know. but I'll be all right.
That was kind of heartbreaking, Taylor.
Yeah, tough to see. I mean, going all the way back to the injury, like the second he got hurt, like he knew it was bad news, and you hate to see a guy who, you know, these guys work so hard to go out and injure that stuff.
Well, and we talked about this with Chris Sale. You know, players feel an accountability when they sign these big contracts. They know they work to be available. They want to be available. And now Trevor Story is going to miss the rest of the year. Just absolutely devastating. On Tuesday, two more pitchers went down with injuries. Nick Pivetta, the Boston Red Sox, an all-star left-hander, Framber Valdez, was scratched with a sore elbow. A lot of pitchers around baseball are weighing in on this topic of injuries, and we'll get to that in a moment. Taylor, what else you got?
Buster, new episode of The Low Post. Zach Lowe talking to Bobby Marks. They're talking about the race in the Western Conference, the race for sixth place, how the top spot will be determined, the muddled East from 2 to 8, who's the biggest threat to Boston out there, what's gone wrong in Cleveland, and they're all defense and all NBA teams. Check it out, The Low Post. He's talking to Bobby Marks. You can listen to it on this platform or watch it on YouTube.
The most recent wave of injuries has been devastating, with Cy Young Award winners and contenders going down seemingly daily. From Garrett Cole of the Yankees to Shane Bieber of the Guardians to the Braves' Spencer Strider. Last Saturday, Union Chief Tony Clark issued a statement directly blaming the advent of the pitch clock for the injuries, without acknowledging how the problem has been growing for years before the clock was even conceived, as well as the longstanding feedback from respected surgeons like James Andrews, who talked about the impact of amateur baseball and year-round throwing programs, and the concern how organizational and player search for velocity and maximum spin has seemingly contributed to the trend of breakdowns. Garrett Cole, the Yankees, spoke with reporters Monday at Yankee Stadium and said he was, quote-unquote, disheartened by the press release dialogue between Major League Baseball and the union, likening them to squabbling parents in a divorce. Left-hander Alex Wood posted a thread on X laying out how pitchers don't really have a chance to rest. He wrote, quote, something being overlooked with the amount of arm injuries recently is the fact that a huge number of players now throw at moderate to high intensity close to year-round. Jameson Taillon of the Cubs retweeted Wood's thread, adding, the talent, work ethic, competitiveness, etc. is at an all-time high. And if you're not working to optimize every last thing, you're falling behind. I also think players are hyper aware of what teams value. ELO, swing and miss, metrics, and chase it. You'd be crazy not to, Jameson wrote. Justin Verlander spoke with reporters after his rehab outing on Sunday, including Ari Alexander, and he offered a thoughtful analysis.
I think the game has changed a lot. I think it'd be easiest to hear and blame the pitch clock. I think in reality, you put everything together and everything has a little bit of influence. I think the biggest thing is that the style of pitching has changed so much. Everybody's throwing as hard as they possibly can and spinning the ball as hard as they possibly can. And it's hard to deny those results, obviously. It's a double-edged sword. How can you tell somebody to go out there and not do that when they're capable of throwing 100? This young guy comes up and throws a pitch 95 and gives up a big homer, and everybody's like, what the hell, man? So something needs to change. I don't have all the answers. I know pitching, I don't want to beat a dead horse here. It is what it is. I think the data's out there at this point. But when the balls started to change back in 2016 and they started flying out a bit more frequently, I know myself personally, that started changing how I had to approach pitching. You have to start swinging, you have to start approaching the batter as, I want swing and miss. I can't have him put the ball in play, where the old adage, pitch down, pitch away from the guy, hit your spot, get weak contact early in the count, and then you can kind of go up, and that kind of went out the window. When everybody started being able to leave the yard, especially opposite field, I've said my piece on that before in the past, and it is what it is. As long as we're all out here competing on an even playing field, that's what I care about, and we all have the same baseball in our hands, so that's that. But I do think that you throw that in the mix, and you throw analytics in the mix, and you throw the pitch clock in the mix, and it all kind of you know, all kind of adds up. And it's unfortunate. I don't know how we rewind the clock. Maybe there's some sort of way to incentivize starting pitching, going deeper in games. You know, I remember I talked to Scherzer at length last year with the Mets, and we talked about having, you know, the starting pitcher be tied to a DH and having, you know, you have to achieve certain milestones before, if the pitcher comes out and he hasn't achieved any of those milestones, you lose your DH. So at least the team is incentivized to teach their pitchers to go through the lineup three times. Whereas right now, nobody's incentivized to do that. No teams are incentivized to tell their pitcher, okay, like, let's go through the lineup three times. Let's navigate a lineup. Those aren't conversations that are had anymore. Nobody's fault. It's just the nature of the game where it's at right now. But if that mind shift switches and teams start incentivizing, okay, how do we get guys out three times? Because right now, third time through the lineup, they're looking for an excuse to take you out. Because analytically, it says that batters have more success third time through. You know, so I can't sit here and blame anybody. But the second that you start incentivizing pitchers staying in the game longer, throwing 110 pitches, throwing 100 pitches, you know, working, navigating the lineup, then the trickle down permeates all the way to Little League baseball. You know, everybody's trying to get to this level. So, you know, you want to go play D1, now you got to throw hard and you got to spin the ball well. You want to go to the minor leagues, you got to throw hard, spin the ball well. And, you know, it all starts from here down. The second that you start incentivizing pitching and guys are getting drafted because they can pitch and get guys out, then that goes down a level and then down a level and down a level. And, you know, I just hope that we don't wait too long because, it's obviously a pandemic and it's going to take years to work itself out because everybody right now, Little League on, go look no further than Instagram. I can't look at my Instagram feed without seeing, you know, some kids trying to learn how to throw as hard as they can at 10 years old. I sure as hell didn't do that. You know, I didn't figure it out until college. I matured into my body. I was, you know, I say it all the time. If I came up in today's world, I don't know what would happen. My mechanics were a little different. I was tall, langly, lean, you know, skinny, lean, weird, kind of hadn't hit my maturity. Went to college, didn't get drafted, went to college and kind of grew into myself. And all of a sudden started throwing hard. But it wasn't because I did some, you know, program to make me throw harder. So it's hard. Hard question.
Jumping into the numbers. This is Hembo Knows on Baseball Tonight.
And Hembo is Paul Amakides, the highest paid researcher in the history of professional sports. Hembo, how are you doing?
Buster, I'm doing great. This season is, of course, off to a rip-roaring start. Not without controversy and not without a bunch of weird things being said by a bunch of highly powered people. But look, the baseball always obscures everything else. The baseball has been great. I've obviously really enjoyed it. There's a lot of sort of nitty gritty to dig into, but look, I'd rather deal with the nitty gritty while getting a chance to watch 15 baseball games a day. The product has been great and there's an awful lot of on-field storylines to discuss. And I'm looking forward to someday getting to those.
And the dominant storyline right now is about pitching injuries. We heard from Justin Verlander. We heard from Garrett Cole, Jameson Taillon, Alex Wood, really thoughtful people. What was your takeaway from what's been said by them?
My biggest takeaway to date, Buster, has been the relationship between Major League Baseball and the union is going to be the single biggest reason why this problem is either never remedied or remedied much further from now than it should. We can agree that this is an existential crisis in baseball. We've gotten a lot of big things right in recent years. I think the rule changes implemented last year are going to go a long way in repopularizing the game and giving it that kind of boost, that oomph that it needed. But make no mistake about it, when a huge swath of the face of your sports, in many cases, starting pitchers, the people who the television cameras are on the most, the people that we grew up idolizing, the legends of the game, are continuously getting their arm split open because of Tommy John surgery and the way in which you get there, it is an existential problem, and it has been one for quite some time, and you and everyone else in the game have known this. And yet, we still find ourselves in a predicament in which Tony Clark, the head of the union, and Major League Baseball are engaged in this ludicrously juvenile PR war in which they're just howling at the moon, and that's not a way that you solve a problem. It might be a way to, in their minds and for their bosses, to win an argument, but candidly, I have found all of that to be way beneath everyone. What we need to find is a couple adults in some room to figure out how we have arrived at this problem and how it can be remedied. And until we arrive at that place, Buster, nothing is going to change.
Ooh, this is a rhetorical question. I'm going to take it down a rhetorical line. Who are the faces of the NFL?
Well, the quarterbacks.
Right. And what did they do?
Protect them.
They protect them. They change the rules. Tom Brady, you know, had a defender basically go at his knee, take it out. They changed the rules. They protected the player. And Major League Baseball now needs to do what it needs to do what it can do, along with the Player Association, in concert with the Player Association, protect the pitchers. To your point, and I think they have to sit down together, get into a room, be civil, and they need to be problem solvers. And that's why I thought what Gerrit Cole said was really good. He didn't name call anybody, but he basically was saying he was disheartened by the conversation. He's exactly right. It's so unproductive, Hembo.
It could not possibly be less productive. In fact, it's counterproductive. The point here is not that one side is right and that one side is wrong and that somehow public sentiment being on your side gets us anywhere. No, no. What would get us somewhere or anywhere would be this not being an epidemic in baseball. That is where we need to get to. That's the spot. And we are no closer to getting there today than we were 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, when this really started to surface as a major problem in our sport. And so there's absolutely no way, no way that Major League Baseball and its pitchers are going to reach a place where this is 1% closer to being solved unless that collaboration occurs. And in that vein, Buster, and I have to say this too, because this is a super important attribute of this discussion. This is coming from the youth levels as well. This is not a problem that Major League Baseball is creating. This is a problem that Major League Baseball is inheriting. You know, I played college baseball. I coached amateur baseball. I've been a researcher at ESPN for 10 years. So I'm eminently qualified to say that this is not a problem that Major League Baseball is creating. From the youth levels of baseball all the way up, Major League Baseball is receiving the talent that we are sending. And the showcase culture and the velocity crazed world that we have created is just as responsible for this, if not more responsible for this, than anything. And that's why you're going to need collaboration from players and league to be able to, on a unified front, message this all the way down. And if you're in order to solve a complicated problem like this, Buster, you're going to need everyone rowing in the same direction. And right now, they are rowing in opposite ones.
Yep, you're exactly right. And you're right, too, about the culture starting early, where faster is better, and you got to throw harder, and you got to throw harder, and pitchers get rewarded. And I thought what Alex Wood, Jameson Taillon, you know, put out on social media, and they talked about how the players know what teams value, right? They value guys who throw really hard. And the teams now have gotten into this group thought, which is, you know what, we can recreate what a starting pitcher used to be able to do by running out, you know, six relievers in a game, seven relievers in a game, and telling them, the message to them is, you just throw your best pitch over and over and over. If it's a breaking ball with a you know, million mile per hour spin rate, that's the way we want you to go. If you throw 103 miles per hour, that's the way we want you to go. To me, it's pretty clear that one potential path which will take baseball off its current trajectory is to get back to valuing length in starting pitchers and to get them to go longer, and the only way you can do that would be if you would actually have pitchers who could figure out a way. I'm thinking of a Justin Steele to get through games without having to throw 100 miles per hour on every pitch. And look, you know, we've talked about, you know, potentially limiting the number of relievers each manager can use in a game. I personally would put it at four. And say that each manager could, you know, during the course of a game, with obvious exceptions for injuries and blowouts, we can use four relievers to incentivize managers to keep starting pitchers in games as long as possible. And, you know, you'd have starting pitchers focused on the idea of trying to get into the sixth and seventh inning. And the other one, and I love the idea, was Max Scherzer, who I first heard it verbalize it last year, the double hook. Hide the designated hitter to the starting pitcher, which is an incentive for the manager to keep an elite hitter in the lineup as long as possible. And by the way, I think if you restore the value of starting pitchers in this way, that helps the union financially because you get starting pitchers stay in the game longer. And I think it would help baseball with offense because I think part of the reason why the offensive numbers have gone down because so many guys, you know, are being used in short relief roles, throwing as hard as they possibly can, and that's diminished offense.
But I got to say, you've hit the nail on the head. I like both of the ideas, but I have to say this. The automatic strike zone is going to make it even harder, even more difficult for nibblers to survive in the big leagues. If we live in a world in which that ball being an eighth of an inch off the plate might be challenged, how is someone like Greg Maddux going to survive today? Like, the reason, Buster, at least in part, why velocity is at a premium is because they're not stretching the zone horizontally, as you know, the way that it used to. Watch an old baseball game. You're getting 6 inches off the black. You're not getting any of that anymore. And so the only time that you can actually afford to miss within the zone is if you're blowing cheese. The only way that you can blow cheese is if you're maxing out. And if you're maxing out, you're probably going to shred your elbow at some point. I love your ideas. The double hook makes a lot of sense. A nine-inning pitcher limit makes a lot of sense because both of those things incentivize the starting pitching. What I'm saying is that in order to get the buy-in, you're going to need from the youth levels up everyone to collaterally be on the same page. Many years ago, little leagues went to pitch limits, and so have high schools and various tournaments when it comes to young pitchers, and that's a net positive. But we know that connective tissue in your elbow doesn't form fully until you're in your mid-20s. By the time many of these pitchers are in their mid-20s, it's way too late in the game. And so I 100% agree with you that we need to reach a place where we create incentives for pitchers not to max out and lengthen themselves within a game. But in order for that to happen, it's going to be more than Major League Baseball sort of enacting a rule. And by the way, I'm not sure that's a fait accompli, but even if it is, or even if we get there, it's going to require a whole lot of more buy-in at the youth levels.
And I think you're 100% right that the back and forth that we saw with the, you know, the statements being volleyed from the bunkers, first from the Player Association and Tony Clark, and from the opposite side from Major League Baseball, tells you how dysfunctional this relationship is. Like, it just, it helps nothing for Tony Clark, in my opinion, to put out this incredibly disingenuous statement and to not acknowledge that the fact that this pitching injuries just weren't started in the start of 2023 with the pitch clock, right? That's been a growing problem within the sport. And it's ridiculous the way that he couched it. And on the other hand, why would Major League Baseball even answer? Why bother answering somebody who's putting out basically fiction, in my opinion?
Alternative facts. Buster, you can't fix a problem this complicated if the people in power don't agree or at least can't sit at the same table as each other. All right. It was hard enough for these people to get us to play baseball. Okay, when the CBA was expired, you couldn't even have the Twins logo on Major League Baseball's website. You think we're going to get together a group of people that we all agree upon to do a long, in-depth study, collaborative study? I mean, that's the problem here. The problem here is leadership on both sides, and nothing will get solved until that changes. I would love to live in a world in which the Justin Verlanders and the Max Scherzers and the Adam Wainwrights and the legendary pitchers of today's game are able to have input in terms of how we might approach this problem and solving it over, let's say, an 8 to 10 to 12 year period of time from the youth level all the way up. But in order to reach that point, it's going to require so many levers to be pulled. And in order for all those things to happen, you need a unified leadership. And right now, across baseball, you have nothing of the kind.
No, and I just want to say this, that the perception of a lot of people in the sport is that Tony Clark's statement was purely political for someone who has been in trouble, as we've been reading about at the top of the union. This is the way to band his players together. And on the opposite side, that the Major League Baseball response was purely political. And neither one of them really solved anything, which is perfect. It's not a good place to be in having these conversations. All right, let's talk about the hot start of Anthony Volpe.
Yes, Buster. Small sample size alert. It's the only sample size we have, but I'm going to give you three reasons why Anthony Volpe is going to take a big step forward this season. Number one, he's much less pull happy at the plate. He was at a 46% pull rate last season, down to 33 through 10 games. His average exit velo on those swings is up 10 miles an hour. So he's using the opposite field more, which I think at least is much more in line with his natural swing path. Number two, Buster, he's been much more selective. Volpe is swinging 11% less frequently in hitters counts, 8% less frequently in pitchers counts, and 7% less frequently in even counts. Thus, more three ball counts in which he's absolutely annihilating the baseball. So he's pulling the ball less and he's more selective. And number three, Buster, he's ready for his first at bat. I'm curious if you'll ever have the chance to ask him about his preparation. Last season, Anthony Volpe hit 135 in his first plate appearance of a game. That ranked 133rd out of 133 qualifiers. He was the worst hitter in baseball the first time up last season. So far, he's 5-for-8 with a walk his first time up. Again, we're talking about incredibly small samples. I do wonder if in his first season, all of the weight, the responsibility of being the Yankee shortstop weighs on you, of course. His preparation, I'd have to imagine, at least in some sense, has changed. And at least in the early going, that is manifesting the first time he steps to the plate.
I wonder if that has something to do with the fact that to date, Aaron Boone has not followed the numbers and put him in the leadoff spot. Because when I'm looking at the Yankees lineup, I'm like, that to me is the absolutely the perfect solution for the top of the leadoff, you know, top of the lineup. Gleyber Torres is off to a slower start. Volpe's killing it. If I'm Aaron Boone, I want a top three of Volpe, Soto, and Judge.
Me too.
Especially with the way that those top two guys would be going. All right, Jose Altuve, last weekend I had a really great, fun conversation about the idea of him reaching 3,000 hits. You know, I mentioned to him, look, I asked that I had asked Albert Pujols when he was about Altuve's age, 34, and what numbers meant something to him in terms of the, you know, the big benchmark statistics that he was potentially chasing going forward. And he goes, no doubt, 3,000 hits. And he gave me a very detailed answer about, you know, I think if I could stay healthy, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this. It's clearly within his crosshairs. What do you think?
I think it's fascinating. 3,000 in baseball, Buster, is magic. You love the history. I love the history. Tim Kirchhoff, who's on today with you, adores the history. 3,000 in baseball is magic. Right now, it's 2,062 hits for Jose Altuve, who, as you said, turns 34 next month. So I just looked at comparable players who, from the age of 34 on, got to basically where he needs to get there. Omar Vizquel had more than 1,200. Craig Biggio had nearly 1,200. Derek Jeter had more than 1,000. And what we can say about Altuve that none of those guys could say is that he has basically the smallest strike zone ever. That is an enormous advantage for Jose Altuve, especially with the automation coming. Jose Altuve is going to have old man skills merely because he has less, we'll call it, surface area to cover than practically any player of his quote-unquote stature in the history of baseball. Look, he still mashes. It's a 159 OPS plus since the start of the 2022 season. He's under contract through his 30s. Now, the question I have, the biggest potential holdup here, Buster, is I'm not sure where he's going to play. He's becoming a liability at second base already. He's minus 28 defensive runs saved over the previous two seasons. And based on his skill set and his frame, of course, you can't put him anywhere else. You also can't DH him. They got Yordan Alvarez out there. So that's going to be the biggest thing for me. Can Jose Altuve fake it in the field long enough for himself to continue to hit his way into the lineup? So long as the answer to that question is yes, I think 3,000 hits is on the table. And if he pulls it off, he'll probably be the last one to ever pull it off.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And yeah, I mean, we're seeing load management now becoming a thing in baseball. And you're right, a player is probably not going to be put in that position. The one thing I'd say is, and you don't look at him and think of him as being a DH, but we remember Craig Biggio down the stretch toward the end of his career. Trey McClain would bring him back and give him the opportunity to do that. I feel like the Jim Crane, the Astros owner, would work to give Altuve an opportunity to get to 3,000 hits if he got close. Say he got within 200 hits, I think they kind of nurse it through to the end. All right, over the weekend, Steven Strasburg officially announced his retirement. What's his legacy?
Better than it should be. Buster, he's going to be remembered less fondly than he should be based upon the facts on the ground. We obviously remember his electric debut in 2010 when his last two at-bats ended in a 99-mile-per-hour strikeout and a 99-mile-per-hour strikeout. It's as electric an arm as you've ever seen in your life. The 32 career WAR, I would say, falls short of what we may have thought he'd become. This is also a guy with some black ink, led the league in strikeouts once, FIP once, wins in innings in 2019. And that's the reason why, Buster, he deserves to be remembered more fondly. His 2019 postseason is the stuff of legend. Five starts. The Nats went 5-0 in those starts. He went six innings in all of them. He allowed three runs or fewer in all of them with a 43-4 strikeout to walk ratio, winning games 2 and 6 of the World Series on the road. How much is a championship worth? Well, in the case of Steven Strasburg and the Nationals, more than $100 million, almost none of which he subsequently earned. But to be the number one pick in the draft and to be a team to be on a team that would not have won the World Series had you not existed is quite a thing to say, and he did it. And so while his career obviously ended super unceremoniously, I would have to say that Steven Strasburg lived up to the billing as the number one pick in the draft because of that 2019 postseason, first and foremost.
And he's emblematic to me of his generation. I'll never forget the first time I ever heard about him was from the late, great Kevin Towers, who went to saw him pitch at San Diego State. And I talked to Kevin right after that. He said, I just saw the greatest pitching prospect ever.
Wow.
And Steven Strasburg was the first guy who comfortably hit 100 miles per hour. And through this, you know, amazing off-speed stuff, you look at the video game highlights, and you're like, wow. And at the same time, it was one of the first indications that, you know what, throwing 100 miles per hour may not be the best thing for a pitcher's physiology, right? Mm. Where right away there were concerns about the way he held the baseball and his backswing, arm swing, about whether or not he was going to last. And now we're talking about so many pitching injuries because of the chase for velocity. I'll always think of that as being something that began with Steven Strasburg.
That's good. I like the word you used, emblematic. That's an excellent choice.
All right, Hembo. Thanks for doing this.
Later, friends.
Get out of here, Hembo. That's sick exactly of Hembo.
Right. Seam heads rejoice. This is Timmy time.
Baseball is the greatest game.
With Tim Kirkson.
It never disappoints you.
On Baseball Tonight.
Tim Kirkson covers baseball for ESPN. And Tim, you know that the loudest words in the sport in recent days have been spoken about the pitching injuries. Tell me what your takeaway has been with all this and what thoughts have been running through your head.
Well, naturally, I'm deeply concerned and I am really sad for the game that four more really good pitchers went down in a 2-day span. I thought Spencer Strider had as good a spring as anyone in baseball. And all of a sudden he's hurt and he might be out for the season. Who knows? It's just another reminder, Buster, that we're doing something wrong here. Okay. And we need to fix it. But the fix is going to take a long time. I think we might have to start literally in Little League and start explaining to these kids that throwing as hard as you can on every single pitch is not what we're looking for here. Swing and miss is not the only thing that matters in pitching. Let's hit a bat once in a while. Let's put the ball in play and let our defense take care of it. But the bottom line is, as long as our pitchers are being told by the industry to throw as hard as you can on every single pitch, and then when you throw your breaking ball, which we throw more often now off speed than we throw our fastball, you're going to have to spin that like it can cut a shirt. It's spinning so fast. If that's what they're thinking every time they go out there, then more and more injuries are going to happen. Now, how we're going to fix this, I don't know, but we're in a really bad spiral right now. And it saddens me that this many pitchers are hurt. And these guys, Strider and Bieber, are on first place teams at the time. This shouldn't be happening, but it is, and we have to somehow slow this down.
Yeah, which is why where I've landed on it, Tim, is I just don't think you're going to ever be able to curtail these injuries and get the industry off the pursuit of velocity or the pursuit of maximum spin unless you make a major rule change. Like, I just don't think that you can, you know, tell a group of minor league pitchers or college pitchers, you can't tell them, look, you really shouldn't be doing this, when they're looking up in the big leagues every day and they're seeing, you know, teams deploying essentially 10 relievers because they throw as hard as they can.
Right. And Buster, I told you this story once, I think. 5 years ago, a veteran major league infielder who was in the minor leagues on an assignment, his pitcher had a 0-2 count, and the guy hit a pop-up to this veteran major leaguer who's on a rehab assignment, and he caught the ball in foul territory for the third out. And the pitcher went to his third baseman and said, why didn't you drop that on purpose? I need to strike these guys out, because if I don't have a good strikeout rate, I'm not getting to the big leagues. If we have brainwashed our pitchers to believe that if you don't throw 98 and your spin rate isn't this and you don't strike out a batter per nine innings, you're not going anywhere, of course they're going to do whatever it takes to throw as hard as they can, strike out as many people as they can, and get to the big leagues. That philosophy has to change. That mindset has to change. But I repeat, it's really going to be hard to do that. And it's really going to be hard for a pitcher to say, okay, I'm not going to try as hard. I'm not going to throw as hard. That's not going to work either. So tell me where we go. I'm not so sure.
Yeah, I think you'd have to make a major rule change. And you know what's interesting is that the San Francisco Giants under Bruce Bochy were always sort of the outlier of front office thought, right, and how they valued things. They didn't necessarily, under Bochy running the Giants, they didn't necessarily value everything that other teams did. And now with the Texas Rangers, Tim, we're seeing it again. Like the way they're running their pitching staff is so different than any other team when it feels like so many clubs right now are just wrapped into this group thought of you got to have as many relievers as possible, throwing as hard as you possibly can. And on the other hand, you have Chris Young and Bruce Bochy having collected this diverse group of pitchers. We saw Bradford the other day throwing to what, the eighth or ninth inning, where Bochy is thinking, and I know from talking my conversation with Mike Maddox, their pitching coach the other day, he's in the same mindset. You know, he was quoting to Carl Ravitch and myself, his brother, Greg Maddox, about the value of changing speeds. I don't know. The group thought right now in Major League Baseball is staggering that you have to get swing and miss. And that seems to be the only path that so many teams recognize.
And Buster, look at the group thought of the Rangers. Bruce Bochy is a four-time world champion. He's going to the Hall of Fame. Mike Maddox is one of the best pitching coaches in the game, and he's almost as old as I am. Well, no one's that old. And we've got Chris Young, who's the smartest guy in the game and pitched in the big leagues for all those years. They are recognizing that that's the wrong way to do it. We have to approach things differently. And Bochy is the perfect guy. Chris Young gave him the reins and say, you run the team. You run the pitching staff. And he and Mike Maddox have done a masterful job. More people should be paying attention to what the Rangers are doing.
Right. And to your point, they just have had nothing but success in the way they're running their pitching staff. And maybe, you know, the group thought will start to include people watching what the Rangers are doing. All right, let's talk about the question of whether or not you're buying or selling on some of these developments early in the season. I'm going to throw a number at you. I'm going to throw a team at you. And you're going to tell me whether or not you're believing in this. The Yankees are 9-2. Are you buying or not that they're this good?
They're not. I'm not buying that they're 9-2 good, but I am buying that their offense, despite some moments this year where they look like last year's offense, they're significantly better. And I think it really helps, Buster, that they've won a bunch of one-run games. And I think they are proving to themselves, thanks mostly to Juan Soto, that we can get a hit here and win the game. We can get a base runner here and win the game, and we can win by one run instead of bludgeoning everyone from the, you know, all or nothing approach. So I don't think they're 9-2 good, but I thought they were a playoff team to start the season. And if Gerrit Cole comes back, say on June the 1st, I think they can win the division, even though I still like the Orioles more than anyone in that division. The Yankees are good, maybe not 9-2 good.
And it's interesting with everything we've seen with the conversation around pitching injuries. As you sit here today and we talk about whether or not Gerrit Cole might come back, I'm assuming he's not. And I don't know. I don't know what the physical state of his elbow is. He just started, as you know, he just started throwing. You hope he does come back. But the injuries are so pervasive that I'm sure that internally the Yankees are planning on that. Yes.
Right. They have to be planning on him coming back. They also have to be planning on him not coming back. And then they have to have another plan in place, because no one's going to feel sorry for the Yankees if they don't make the playoffs and Gerrit Cole doesn't pitch all year. They better have a plan B. And it just scares the life out of me for the game that these big pitchers are going down. And that's the first thing on your mind, Buster. I don't think he's coming back, as opposed to the other way around. How could you not think that way after the last 5 to 10 years of injuries?
Yeah, the Cleveland Guardians are 8-2 as you and I speak. Are you buying that they're this good?
No, I'm not buying they're this good, but they're much better than I thought they were going to be. They've scored a few more runs. Their pitching has been awfully good so far. They have a big-time closer, and I don't know how they're going to get enough starting pitching to make up for what's going to be a lack of offense moving forward, because I just don't see them scoring enough runs without Shane Bieber in there. So I think they're good enough to win a very winnable division. But 8-2 is .800 baseball. I'm not buying that they're that good. But the manager's really good. Buster, you know, nobody loves Tito Francona more than I do, and he's irreplaceable. But I'm telling you, Stephen Vogt has a pretty good idea of what this job's about, and he's only been doing it for 2.5 weeks.
The Marlins are the worst team in baseball so far when you look at their record. They finally won a game for the first time over the weekend. Could they be this bad and headed toward a major sell-off?
They can't be 1-10 bad, but I think they are headed for a major sell-off. Jesus Luzardo could help about 20 teams right now. And if the Marlins are honest with where they are right now in a division with the Braves and the Phillies, and they're 1-10, and they're not a very good offensive team, and Yuri Perez is out for the year, as is Sandy Alcantara, they're going to have to do something. Look, they're not the worst team. The White Sox are worse. The A's will be worse. But they're not a good team, and they need to make some moves in order to turn this program around.
Boy, Luis Arraez would be attracted to a lot of pennant-contending teams if he's put out on the trade market in July, and they should, in theory, get value for him. You know, we were at the time that Kim Ng was offered a demotion after they made the playoffs in full season for the first time in decades. And she turned that down and left the organization. You know, I was very critical of the Marlins. And Tim, now, you know, we get news initially from Bob Nightingale of USA Today that the Marlins removed the option on the contract for Skip Schumacher. He's now under contract through 2000, the rest of this season, and then he can become a free agent. It's incomprehensible to me. Tim, it feels like they're greasing the skids for Skip Schumacher to leave when I think he's already established himself just 1 year in as one of the most coveted managers in baseball. That would be like going to a player and saying, yeah, we know we have an option year on you and you're one of the, you know, the candidates for MVP and Cy Young Award. But you know what? We're just going to let you go at the end of the year. Skip Schumacher has value, Tim. It makes no sense to me. Why would they do that?
I don't understand. He was the manager of the year last year. He is really good at this. They have really given good. Him very little to work with, and they're off to a terrible start, and all their pitchers are hurt, and we're going to take his option away. Buster, there's a reason that Derek Jeter left. There's a reason that Kim Ng left. It has to start at the top. And I don't know where the problem is, but if it starts at the top, it's going to filter down. And it's amazing they made the playoffs last year, but they're in a lot of trouble right now.
Yeah, it's absolutely remarkable that they're going to be in this position to see that sort of a talent drain, especially coming off a year in which they actually made the playoffs. The Pirates are in first place in the National League Central. You buying or no?
I'm buying it. This one I'm buying, Buster. Again, winnable division. Brewers are better than we thought. Reds, they're pretty exciting. Cubs have some good things going. But I'm telling you, the Pirates, I know they got off to a great start last year and then fizzled, but they're a little different. That Jared Jones guy is really good. I've seen both of his starts now. He's got great stuff. Paul Skeens is on the way. He's already on small sample, tearing up in the minor leagues. They have some interesting players with O'Neill Cruz back. So I'm not suggesting they're definitely going to win the division or they're 8-2 is exactly where they're going to be 2 months from now. I'm saying that they are in this division race with everyone else, in part because the division is weak, but they are off to a great start. I've seen it 100 times, Buster. A young team gets hot, and all of a sudden they start to say, hey, we don't stink. We're pretty good now. And then they take off.
The Dodgers are 9-4. They already have a 3-game lead over the pack in the National League West. Does anybody catch the Dodgers this season, Tim?
Not in the West. It's the Dodgers lineup. Just go. It's like, look at the first four guys of that order, which we've talked about a million times, but it's like 370, 340, 350, 400. Those are the first four batting averages in that Dodger order. Their offense is spectacular. And if it weren't for the Braves, we'd be calling this one of the best offenses we've seen in a while. That's how good they are offensively. And they're going to get all those pitchers back. Look, I love what the Diamondbacks did last year and the way they play. The Padres are going to play better than this, and so are the Giants. But the Dodgers are just better than everyone else because of the depth they have and the resources they have.
All right, Tim. Well, thanks for doing that. Good to talk with you. Between now and next week, please come up with a solution for all the pitching injuries.
It's going to take longer than that, Buster. Thanks.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for a Wednesday. We got some good ones. We're going to start off with your tweets here. You've got a couple
nice.
You want to share. Well, at least one you want to share and one I want to share. So you go ahead.
Well, the one I want to share is I want to do a little victory lap from 2013, okay? When I tweeted out about Jackson Holiday, I wrote that Matt Holiday's son is going to be an all-star. What's kind of fun about that from 2013, at that time, Jackson was 9 or 10 years old, and the response from so many people on social media was sort of classic for social media, whereas there's this reflexive response to just fire back and call somebody an idiot. Right?
Right.
And here we are today. He's being promoted to the big leagues. You knew back then, and I was hardly alone. I've seen a lot of stories from a lot of writers. When you saw Jackson Holiday swing a bat, and I first met him when he was 3 years old. You know, I remember being in a cage and Matt introducing me to him, and then seeing him year after year after year get bigger and stronger, and that swing was just so fluid. You're like, oh, man, this guy is going to be around for a long time in the big leagues.
Very cool, man. I mean, 11 years ago in your bag here. That's awesome. And I got to point out something else. You tweeted out, Jackson Holliday's AAA stats, and you said he is considered to be the best 23 under player in professional baseball by a number of rival evaluators. You said that at the top of the show, and someone tweeted at you, Gunnar Henderson is 22. And you said, okay, the statement stands. Oh, right. Man.
And I don't understand this because I just related what I'm hearing from executives. Like, I'm not really, a talent evaluator. And I'm calling around with an open-ended question. Who's the best 23 and under player in baseball? And that list, as I told you before, Corbin Carroll, Julio Rodriguez, Gunnar Henderson. And what are evaluators telling me? Jackson Holiday. It's not my opinion. I'm relating opinions I'm getting from people with teams in high offices who don't want their name used because they don't want to be dumping on their own players. But it tells you how highly he's held, with respect and esteem in the sport.
He is held with more respect and esteem, in terms of performance than the reigning AL Rookie of the Year. I mean, that is incredible. That is so cool. My excitement level.
I'm excited.
Man, this is going to be.
Yeah, and
so
I told
cool.
you about, I've got my Jerry Jones, Jimmy Johnson, yes. fight with my son with our fantasy team. Uh-huh. I told him before the season started, you have to draft Jackson Holiday. And so my son's been complaining because he's been on layaway, right? He's taken up a roster spot. My son is like, why are we doing here? How come we're doing this? I'm like, just wait, dude. Just wait.
Oh, man. Jake, he's got to listen. He's got to listen to his old man. He'll learn one day. All right. Well, people who do want to listen to Buster, the Bleacher Tweeters, let's go to a couple voicemails here.
Good morning, Buster. This is Byron here in Taiwan. I heard Justin Verlander bring this up, and then Garrett Cole, my guy for the Yankees, brought it up too. But talking about the rash of pitching injuries and maybe the sped-up pitch clock being guilty of this, are we actually seeing more pitching injuries now or just more famous guys? Love the show. First time caller, forever fan. Thanks, guys. Cheers.
That is a great and fair question. And the answer is yes. The number of injuries are climbing. And the data year to year, and maybe I'll have Sarah Langs later in the week sort of detail it. 2014 compared to 2024, going 10-year windows. The number is skyrocketing. The interesting thing is, though, that data also indicates that there are more, and I said this on the show on Monday, there were more injury lists, pitchers going on the injury list in 2022 than there were in 2023 after the advent of the pitching clock. So Tony Clark's statement that the pitching injuries are about the pitch clock, it's ridiculous.
Oh, goodness. Well, that leads in nicely to a voicemail from the Stone King himself.
Hey, guys. It's Brian Stone King from SoCal.
Yeah.
And I wanted to weigh in on this Tony Clark complaint about the pitch clock. First of all, I think if he wants the MLB to investigate, why doesn't he have the Players Association investigate their own and then bring that report to the MLB? Secondly, the pitch clock has been in the minor leagues since 2015. So for 9 years, guys have been coming through the system, getting used to it. That's all I got.
It's a good point.
I think he's right. And I like the, you know, the sentiment behind it was, hey, do your work and look to do something to help address and fix the problem instead of just volleying a press release and then staying in a bunker. You know, I love Jeff Passan's column the other day. I don't know if you got a chance to read it, but he basically said, look, come together. And I love Garrett Cole casting them as, you know, divorcing parents, right? Like, stop arguing and start helping the kid. Start looking to, you know, to make the problem better.
Garrett Cole bringing people together. Not something I thought I'd ever say. Let's go to the next voicemail.
Hey, Buster and Taylor, this is Jonathan from Los Angeles, huge Dodgers fan and president of the Shohei Ohtani Fan Club. Question about this notion, and it's been brought up by you, Buster, and others, that Shohei's lack of availability to the media perhaps causes some conflict in the clubhouse or some pushback from teammates. My question is, if that's the case, why don't or can't perhaps other players, if they feel that way, simply also take themselves out of consideration for media questions? What would be the ramifications or repercussions of that if other players just said, you know, I don't want to field those questions either?
And if you're asking specifically about questions about Ohtani's situation, that has happened. Like, I've heard about other Dodger players being asked about Ohtani who say, look, I don't want to talk about it. Like, they defer it, but they also don't like to be bothered with it. And they know that if Ohtani talked, then they wouldn't probably be asked the questions. When it comes, if you're speaking generally, if other players maybe would fall in line with Ohtani and say, we're not going to do media availability, boy. I'll go back to, you know, I remember a conversation I had, and Taylor, I'm sure I've told you about it before, when Peter Angelos, the owner of the Orioles, used to rage at me about what Ken Rosenthal was writing in his column, and he would threaten to take away our press passes. And then he would sort of gather himself up after he finished his rant, and he would say, you know what? I get three free pages of advertising in the Baltimore Sun every day. Like, so he understood potentially the impact of having the media availability. You know, we're talking about the Ohtani story. It's a, you know, it's certainly not one that baseball wants, but there's so many other great stories that happen every day within baseball that come out of conversations between players and media members. So if you're speaking generally, I'll tell you this, that'll never happen. You know, we just had a fun time over the weekend with Ranger players. You know, Evan Carter was mic'd up. He couldn't have been more comfortable, couldn't have been greater. You know, gave fans, customers, patrons a window into who he is. We've seen that with Adley Rutschman. We've seen it with other, you know, so many other players, and they benefit from that. So I don't think most players pull back the way that Ohtani does.
Hi, Buster. This is Andy from San Diego. With Steven Strasburg's recent retirement, do the Nationals still owe him his contracted money, or is it negated? Also, will Todd be doing any more Forbidden Fields? Thank you. Love the show.
No, Todd's not doing Forbidden Fields, but we do have the new entry. We're going to hear his next, you know, his next chapter on in the next podcast. He's now joining us with a weekly episode. So still more Todd, right? We can't get enough Todd, that's for sure. And I think I'm going to ask him about, how about Riley Green tearing up his pants, the Fanatics pants, with a slide yesterday. Did you see that, Taylor?
I didn't, but that
is. Oh, my God. You have to watch it, because, of course, it just led to the jokes. He slid in, just a regular old slide into home plate, and he got up, and his pants, his uniform pants, were basically torn from the hip down to below his knee on the seam. And he was, like, making fun of it in the dugout.
I mean,
with a regular slide that happened.
They look terrible, and I'm glad they are functionally terrible as well. So maybe Major League Baseball and Nike and Fanatics will do something about it. We'll see. Is Strasburg's getting paid, right? He's getting all that money.
Strasburg, as far as it, look, I haven't, you know, reached out to MLB and to Scott Boras to confirm that. But, you know, players don't give up salary when they retire because of an injury. They get paid their money. You know, there was some dispute where I think the Nationals are trying to convince him to take, you know, take some sort of a settlement. And Strasburg rightly said, you know, I mean, observing the precedent, he should get paid for the rest of his contract.
Yeah, for sure. We got one tweet here and we will wrap it up. Don Irvine writes in, will there ever be a day when cities don't cough up money to attract and retain teams, or is it so ingrained that it is a given?
I don't know. The vote in Kansas City last week was really interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Like, I was surprised that they got slam dunked on, because that is a place that, you know, has always have been a place where the customers, you know, citizens have been very willing to give up money to fund stadiums. And so you do wonder if going forward, some of the political anger that's out there is going to manifest when it comes to stadiums. The one thing I would say, and I had this idea on Monday, Major League Baseball to just go to John Fisher, say, we're going to buy the Oakland Athletics. We're going to control the team. And then you put that franchise up for bid. You tell Oakland, you tell Sacramento, you tell Las Vegas, okay, bring us your offers. Whoever gives us the best stadium deal. And I think that's a situation where they would wind up with a sweet stadium deal. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And John Fisher would make lots of money. And that's his favorite thing to do. So I think everyone wins in that situation.
Right, exactly. And you get the person in your golf club who's running around the course in a jockstrap, you get to kick him out of the club, right?
Absolutely. Goodbye, John Fisher. All right, that's it for Bleacher Tweets. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. The phone number, if you want to call in, 406-404-8460. I should probably read that at the top of the segment. It is in the show notes. And one last time for today. Holiday,
oh, holiday. Nice. I can't wait. This is going to be fun to watch. All right, that's it for today. My thanks to Taylor, to Hembo, to Tim Kirkjian, and thanks to, you know, Gerrit Cole and Justin Verlander and others weighing in on this pitching injury thing. Those guys know a lot more than I ever would, for sure. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.